Hi, I'm WTOP Entertainment Editor Jason Fraley, and we are being joined by David O. Stewart, who is the author of the new book about George Washington called George Washington, The Political Rise of America's Founding Father. Hey, thanks so much for joining us, David.
Well, thanks for having me.
Okay, so now I want to get into, you know, the five political minefields that you lay out that he had to go through. But before we get to those, and you start the book with sort of his first 43 years of life, learning hard truths about the world. Explain why you wanted to approach it that way.
Well, I think we tend to think of Washington as this sort of the guy who went through life effortlessly, and, you know, he was tall and he married a rich woman and everything was cool. And in fact, he had a lot of trouble in his early years. He wanted to be a soldier in the French and Indian War. He commanded Virginia troops fighting the French and the Indians, and it didn't go well, by and large. And he then had to decide to reinvent himself, and he chose a political career. And he spent 16 years really learning the political craft. And I think we should not neglect that. We should pay attention to someone who takes the trouble to school himself and notice how he does it. And then I wanted to look at those crises that he faced to appreciate just how much he had learned for himself and how good he was.
Absolutely. Well, let's go into those crises that you mentioned. The first one is the whole winter of despair, as everyone calls it, in Valley Forge in 1778. How trying was that on him, and how did it shape him?
It was a terrible time. The army had just lost two battles, so everybody was feeling pretty bad. It was cold. The weather was terrible. They didn't have enough food. They didn't have clothes that they needed. The supply system had totally broken down, and Washington needed to overhaul that. He also was dealing with other generals who were scheming to move him out, to have him replaced by General Horatio Gates, who had just won a big battle against the British in Saratoga in New York. And he also had to retrain his army. He'd had a terrible time with an army that was not well-trained. The soldiers would come on 90-day duty or six-month duty, and they would not quite learn their jobs, and then they'd go home. And so he had to deal with all three of those challenges at once. So it was a very difficult time. It tested his leadership abilities. As a politician, he had to use the strength he got from Congress, since Congress really was in charge of the country, both to fend off this effort to move him out of the commander-in-chief job and also to remake the supply services and then to remake the army. So it was a real challenge, mostly a political challenge, and one he rose to.
Exactly. You sort of started getting into not just the early, you know, during the war days, but then the sort of that period between 1783 after the war and building all the way up to the chaotic political time leading up to the new constitution in 1787. Why was he the right man in history for that? I mean, man, we've talked about peaceful transition of power and all kinds of stuff a lot lately, but man, how important was it we had George Washington between 1783 and 1787? I mean, the nation could have gone a million ways then, but we had him.
We were so fortunate, and the quality of Washington that made all the difference was he wasn't power mad. He would do his duty. If he was asked to perform a public function, he would do the best he could with it. But then he wanted to go home. And when the war was over, he could have made himself president, tyrant, despot, king, call it whatever you want. And lots of victorious generals have done that through history. Napoleon Bonaparte did it, Oliver Cromwell, Julius Caesar. But Washington went home, he resigned. When King George III heard about that Washington had resigned, he said, if he's really done that, he didn't quite believe that anybody would do that. But he said, if he's really done that, he's the greatest man in the world. And that's what Americans thought. They thought, okay, we can trust this guy. And so they did. And, you know, that period after the war, but before the Constitution is approved, we really were in danger of falling apart as a nation. And it was, I do believe, only because Washington was there to lead us out of that terrible time. It was the worst economic depression we've ever had, that we were able to survive, write that new Constitution, and build a new government.
So well said. You mentioned, you know, you write about that period, you know, there's a brand new federal government here that he's running, very first president, uncharted territory here. You talk about how there was a, you know, a financial crisis, trying to restore the nation's credit solvency. Explain to our listeners what you mean by that.
Well, we had terrible debts coming out of the war, which everybody has terrible debts coming out of a war, but we also had a nation full of people who didn't like to pay taxes, which probably also describes a lot of countries. And we'd gone to war because we didn't want to pay taxes. So Washington had to figure out a way to reorganize our finances to pay enough of our debts that we would command the confidence of other nations and of financial community. And he was fortunate to have Alexander Hamilton as his Treasury Secretary, who could put together that plan, which Washington adopted. I mean, we always call it Hamilton's plan, but it was really Washington's plan. He was the president. And then it was not easy to get it adopted by Congress. There was a lot of resistance to different parts of it, and a delicate political agreement had to be crafted. And I think Washington was the guy who ultimately made that happen too. And the trade was, in return for the financial solution, which Northerners wanted, the capital of the nation, the new capital, was placed on the Potomac River where the Southerners wanted it. So each side got one thing. And the thing that people tend not to notice is George Washington got everything he wanted. So the only person to walk from the table with all the chips was George Washington. So I think he ought to get some credit for that.
Absolutely. And a third major challenge he faced, you know, you just went into a lot of the financial stuff, but was after we had our American Revolution, there was other revolutions, French Revolution, everything happening in Europe. Talk about how it was, you know, go further into how it was important that he kept us out of a full-on European war as well. And that sort of, if that helped ease and cool any tensions by, you know, French and British people here and abroad.
Well, this is one way in which the politics of the 1790s were so different from ours, because Americans really divided over whether they were pro-British or pro-French. They would march, have competing marches supporting the British or the French. And we sympathized with the French because they were having their own revolution, and so did we, and because they had supported us in our war with Britain. But there were a lot of Americans who said, wait a second, we do 90% of our trade with Britain. That's where all of our traditions, our legal traditions, come from. Sure, we just fought them, but it's stupid to get into a fight with Britain. And Washington realized that the most important thing was to remain neutral, just stay out of it. We were still recovering from the Depression, from our own Revolutionary War, which had been a terrible disaster all around the nation. And he struggled hard to keep us out of that war. He had to resist. There was a famous French ambassador named Genet, Citizen Genet, who tried desperately to get us, lure us in on the French side. Washington resisted that. He then reached out to the British to make a treaty with them. He couldn't get a very good treaty, but he got the best he could. And he was able to keep the nation out of the war. And that was just so important at that time. It was a great achievement.
Absolutely. And then sort of finally, his big final, you know, in his later years, a question we're all still grappling with, really, as we look back at history, his internal struggle with human slavery. You know, you go visit Mount Vernon, and there's a whole giant cemetery where, you know, the slaves are buried, and not to mention the slave quarters. And we go the same, it's the same question we have with Thomas Jefferson and Monticello, where it's, you know, the musical Hamilton grapples with it as a current example. But, you know, how on earth could these people who wrote such brilliant things say, you know, all men are created equal, but then they themselves go home to a plantation where they're slave masters? Talk about what was Washington's thinking on that subject? You know, was he hoping to try to point his fellow people towards a redemption of some kind and over breaking that shackle? Or was he just a product of his time? Or, you know, what was his thinking in his later years?
You know, in his early years, there's no evidence that he was much bothered by slavery. It was just part of his world. During the war, he was profoundly moved by the fact that Black soldiers were fighting and dying for his liberty and his freedom, and that changed him. And after the war, he tried to figure out a way to get out of slavery, out of involvement with slavery. And it was complicated because he owned about 100 slaves plus in his own right, but more than 100 of the slaves at Mount Vernon were owned by the estate of Martha's first husband. They were the Custis slaves. And Washington had control of them, but he couldn't just free them. He could only use them. So in order to free them, he was going to have to buy them out of the estate. So he spent 10 years trying to raise the money to buy them out of the estate and then to free his own slaves, and then he would be out of it. And he never could get the money together to do it. So when he was finally in his last year of life, he rewrote his will to emancipate his slaves upon his death. And he could not do anything about the Custis slaves. So that's how it was resolved. He had said that his slaves would not be released until Martha also died, but she didn't like having them around, knowing that all they stood between them and freedom was her life. It made her scared. So she then freed them. And he left enough money to support the older slaves through their end of their lives and to educate the younger ones. Indeed, the last payment to support the slaves from his estate happened 33 years after his death. I think he did that as an act of personal atonement. I think he might have hoped that it would inspire others to free their slaves, but he was too hard-headed a guy to think that really was going to happen.
Well, sort of along those lines, big picture for me, like, why is it so important to go back and study folks, gigantic forces in history like George Washington? You know, there might be, let's say there's some younger folks listening to this who, you know, might say, you know, oh, who cares about someone that old and someone who owns slaves, screw that guy kind of a mindset. Talk to them why, yeah, you know, maybe that might be, you know, your political opinion now, maybe, but talk about why it's so important to go back and study these massive figures who basically invented the entire country and the entire conflict we face today. It's all there in the beginning. So why is it important, especially for a biographer like you, to keep going back to these men?
Well, you've very well stated some of the reasons. And I think we understand our own day better when we see why we have structures that we have. Why do we have this hideous residue of those slave years? But I think it's also an opportunity to understand qualities that we should be thinking about in our leaders. Washington was a man of great character and integrity and was admired for that. He was a humble man. And those are qualities that wore very well. And perhaps we should be looking for that more than we are looking for someone that we just agree with on
some trade agreement or some tax policy.
Totally. And then just before we run some of the logistics of you putting it together, you know, how long have you spent, did you spend researching and working on this book?
It took about 5 years. I was fortunate to be working on it now when a lot of the records are digitized and are available from home. And that made it a lot easier than it would have been 20 years ago. And when you spend, biographers talk about this, you know, when you're choosing a topic for your book, you're going to spend a lot of time with this person. You'd like it to be somebody you don't mind spending time with. And I found that I was glad to spend time with George Washington.
Awesome. Well, we're glad to spend time with you. So thanks so much for doing this. We'll get it up on Monday, just in time for the President's Day. So we really, really appreciate you joining us. Can't wait for our listeners to check out the book.
Thank you, Jason.